Welcome to Innovation Calling,
the podcast where we connect the creators for the next big thing. We're your hosts, Aaron Smith
and Sia Yasotornra.
All right, welcome to another episode of the Innovation Calling podcast. I'm Aaron Smith.
And I'm Sia Yasotornra. We are super excited to welcome our super happy guest, Mr. Ed Marks, to the Innovation Calling podcast. Ed is a well-respected thought leader and innovator with 20-plus years, and I'll say it nicely, 20-plus years in technology and business leadership. If we can stress one thing about Ed Marks, he is a super passionate, extremely disciplined, and completely dedicated to improving our experiences within the healthcare industry. Ed is currently the CIO of the Cleveland Clinic, and he joins us today to help us understand the state of digital healthcare and the evolving role of the CIO, especially in today's, you know, social media influence society. So thank you, Ed, and welcome to the Innovation Calling podcast.
Thank you. I'm very honored and excited to be part of this.
So, Ed, I've known you for a while now, and, you know, I'm always impressed by your enthusiasm. You embrace life and you take it by the horns. So before I dive into the world of digital healthcare and the evolving world of the CIO, I have to ask you, where does your enthusiasm come from? You know, what I ideally like to do as now an entrepreneur is I'd like to put it in a bottle and market it to the masses. So what do you attribute to? Where do you get your passion from?
I don't know. I just love life and I'm happy to be alive. And I just think we have this amazing opportunity in our lives to do amazing things. And so it's exciting that we live in a world today where almost everyone has opportunities, especially in the West, to make something happen and impact the world and change the world. And so it's like, wow, I get to be part of that. And I'm not a victim of circumstance. And I take a lot of strength and pride from my parents, you know, who my dad specifically, a Holocaust survivor, came to the United States eventually with nothing. And the United States gave him this amazing opportunity, and he was a very successful person by many different accounts. So it's like, wow, we're so lucky to be alive, and let's make something happen and do good for the world. So it's just, to me, it's infectious. I just love it.
And then right there is, I completely forgot, and I apologize. I did not remember that your father was a Holocaust survivor. That have had to make such a great impression on you. Did he teach you anything else as far as that? I mean, obviously he went through a lot. Was there anything else that might have struck you more, maybe that discipline side of you? Because I get passion, and you can have passion, but yeah, if you can't have the discipline to execute, I could see where, you know, all good ideas with no plan can fail.
Yeah, what is it? Execution or vision without execution is a broken promise. And so you need both. You need vision and you need the passion, and then you need to be able to execute. So yeah, I learned a lot of discipline from my parents growing up, again, from very, very humble beginnings. And they made something of themselves despite having no education and, you know, having a terrible war experience. And so that was part of it. And then in the military, helped form, shape the young Ed as a 17-year-old in basic training and learning about physical fitness and the discipline required. I did a lot of sports before that as well. So over time, I just learned, wow, to accomplish certain goals, you need to be disciplined. And then if you get up earlier than other people, you can be average, but have above average outcomes. And so that's what I did. I knew I was an average soldier. So I got up earlier than everyone else and had above average results. I was an average officer, Army engineer officer. And I was like afraid of flunking out of engineering school because I was a psych major at the time. So I got up earlier than everyone else and graduated top 10% of my engineering school. So I've just applied that same sort of edict throughout my life. It's like, hey, you know, I'm a pretty average person with very humble beginnings, but I can have extraordinary results if I just put in extra work and that discipline. So it kind of reinforces itself over time. So you find out, wow, by getting up earlier and working out, or like when I used to play tennis, I used to literally a half hour before any of my tennis mates showed up, I used to serve about 1,000 balls, you know, tennis balls, serve them. And when they came, even though I was an average server, my serves were a little bit above average because I spent just knocked over 1,000. So I learned quickly I could apply that same sort of discipline to my work life, my family life, and all that kind of stuff. And so it just became a part of who I was. So you just get up earlier.
I love it. So easy.
Well, just get up early. For a non-morning person, I can't tell you that advice is like you're asking me like for the worst thing that I could. Now, ask me to stay up later to do it, maybe.
Yeah, but for some people, it's later. But the point is you give that little extra. They say it's lonely on the path of the extra mile. You know, people talk about, hey, just go that extra mile. Well, you go that extra mile, there's very few people on it. There is very few people out there running at 4:30 a.m. And so they may not run at all. Or they might run at 6, but only run half the distance. So even though I'm an average runner, in a race, I'll beat them because I got up earlier.
That's true. And I've seen that professionally as far as you have always been much more awake and alert. And I think getting up early, getting their exercise and blood flowing, I think it really does help with cognitive thinking.
Yeah. And on the work side too, you know, to give a work analogy, it's like reading or listening to podcasts. So I'm always like reading. Like this morning I was on the Stairmaster for an hour. I'm reading this book called Measure What Matters. That's like the big book right now for us at Cleveland Clinic. And I'm always listening podcasts. I'm always reading. I'm always like on Twitter, looking up articles that seem interesting, or on LinkedIn, what people write. And so I'm average, but I get some above average results because a lot of my peers are just whatever they learned 10, 15, 20 years ago, that's it. But I realize, dang, I'm sort of average. So if I want to perform well, meet my own personal expectations as well as my manager, dang, I better do a little extra. And so that's what I do. So why not exercise and read at the same time?
I can't read and walk at the same time. I think walking and chewing gum is really tough for me. So maybe I should practice that a little bit more then.
Or, you know, it's any combination. I'm just giving you some random examples, but it's any way to combine things and you save time and you just enrich your life, which then enriches other people's lives.
Well, I think that's really great bit of advice. I don't know how I can market that and market into a bottle though. Trying to figure that out. We're going to make our millions off you, Ed. Mm-hmm. Think of more stuff too, and then we'll figure that out towards the end. How about that? So on that note though, you know, we've been talking about healthcare. Obviously it's a hot button, you know, politically. I think we're at that stage in technology where we're really looking at more of an interactive way of viewing how we as a society receive our healthcare, how we view our own lives and the way we can take care of ourselves. So could you help me understand what you define digital healthcare for yourself, and then for how your career has evolved and now currently at Cleveland Clinic?
Yeah, so everyone has a different definition of digital, so I don't know that there's a perfect one. But to me, it's the natural evolution of technology combined with the user experience. So, you know, 10 years ago, we talked about mobility, or 15 years ago was e-commerce. No one talks about e-commerce anymore. It's just a natural thing, who we are, what we do. You know, no one talks about mobility as much as we did a few years ago because everyone now is mobile enabled. That's just the way of life. And so digital is nothing more, and especially in healthcare, it's just the natural evolution of technology. I imagine 5 years from now, we won't be calling it digital anymore. It'll just be a natural part of how healthcare is delivered. But because it helps sort of define and catalyze and focus, you know, we adopt the same sort of thing. So I think it's both a cultural phenomena as well as, you know, a technology phenomena. So it really redefines the whole user experience. So specifically to healthcare, with the patient to the clinician, clinician to clinician, patient to family, clinician to family. So the whole thing is a new way of looking at things and working with one another that has great potential to rapidly impact the quality of care. Because for a variety of reasons, you know, again, we'll get into this a little bit later, I suppose, but for one major thing is patient engagement. So I think one thing that's been lacking in the past, we haven't had a tool to really engage patient, but now the patient becomes more and more engaged with their own health. So I've got so many examples, I don't want to jump too far ahead, so I'll just stop there. That's sort of my definition. You know, it's really the merging together of technology, the natural evolution of technology with a user experience, and the whole cultural phenomena wrapped around it. And that's sort of digital health. And it has the potential to transform healthcare the way we know it today.
I was going to say, well, to that point, we want to get into the current state. I would love to go a little deeper into how, you know, for the example you talked about the patient really being more enabled and taking care of their own health. Can you give some more examples of that or go even deeper into that about how it really is changing?
Yeah, I'll give you one really deeply personal one. So, you know, about a month ago, I won't go into detail for the sake of time on the podcast, but I was running this race. And in the last mile and a half, I suffered this massive heart attack known as an LAD or Widowmaker, because, you know, most people die right away. And so I made it through, obviously, otherwise I wouldn't be a special guest on your podcast. And so I got these tools that one's a remote EKG, all Bluetooth, and another one is a heart monitor and pulse. And I'm able on my own to take these measurements. Okay, so now I'm engaged at a level different than a patient of the past. So it's kind of ironic that those technologies that I've advocated for, I'm now an evangelist of because I'm a user myself. So I'm doing these readings daily and I care. It's like, dang, I wonder if this medicine's working. I wonder if my exercise rehab program is working. And I get real time feedback. Then that feedback goes directly in without me having to do anything after the initial setup, goes into my electronic health record where my clinicians are alerted, and they are contacting me and making real-time adjustments to my medications. Now, in the past, so I have a follow-up appointment May 22nd. In the past, it would have been 4 weeks where I'm going to come in and they're going to do vitals, and based on my vitals, they're going to decide what to up or lower my meds. Okay, that's 4 weeks. Now, instead of waiting 4 weeks, every week they're adjusting my meds already because I'm engaged. I'm providing the feedback because I have to, you know, take the measurements and things like that. But again, it's very, very simple to do. And so I'm like really into it now, like more than I would have been if I was waiting 4 weeks or 6 weeks for an appointment for them then to take action. So they've already made changes to my exercise requirements, everything. And every week it's updated because I'm engaged. So that's a missing piece. And you know, studies have proven that the more engaged the patient, the better the outcome. So it's not like I'm going to skip my meds or skip anything, because two reasons. One, I'm engaged because I get to see and be part of it, and I enjoy that part. But the other thing is I'm held accountable. So in the past, you show up, well, I'm sorry, doc, you know, I didn't eat right, or and you make some excuse, but you got away with it for 4 weeks. Well, now I'm measuring myself every day. So I'll be held accountable on a weekly basis now, not, you know, once I show up to appointment. So that's a very practical, real example of how digital health helps with this engagement. And I think you get better outcomes.
So right there, I didn't think about this accountability. I just think of, I'm thinking more of the context of real-time data. Like you say, through EHR, electronic health records, the doctors are able to give you real-time assessments saying maybe the meds should be adjusted accordingly. I didn't even think about the other side, which is probably the frustration that most healthcare providers have, is the fact that we ourselves are probably not doing ourselves any favors in our own healthcare routine. I didn't even think about that at all, actually.
And then another example, less personal, is the whole concept. So I think we're going to see a shift, you know, because obviously cost is still a big issue.
Yes.
So we need to figure out, you know, everyone's seen the studies about how where United States ranks in costs, you know, we're the most expensive, but our outcomes aren't as high as other countries that spend less. So there's definitely an issue. Now there's some explanation for that variance, but there's still a variance that's unexplained. So one thing we need to do is become smarter. So with digital technology, so this is what we do today, and I think this is the future. So we call it hospital at home. So we have patients that come in that used to be admitted. And instead of admitting them, and that's no fun for the patient, it's dangerous for the patient, right? Not necessarily at the Cleveland Clinic, but we know from statistics that once you're admitted with the hospital, you can get some hospital-acquired infection, some other issue that you didn't have before you went. So, you know, hospital's not necessarily the safest place, so it's not a fun place. As much as at the Cleveland Clinic, we try to make it as We're very patient focused and all about the patient experience. So we do a lot to make sure that it is a great experience. But on the whole, net, right? No one wants to be in a hospital. It's dangerous, as I mentioned. Some hospitals are dangerous. And it's expensive. So what we're doing is identifying the set of patients that we can send home with the appropriate technology. And it's easy stuff. It's just Bluetooth. It's easy to set up because everyone is so digitally enabled these days. And then they convalesce at home. And so far, our early experience has shown that the quality of care is higher, the same or higher. So the outcomes are the same or higher. The patient engagement and the patient experience is higher. So we measure that. And the cost is about half. So as technology evolves, people become more comfortable. We have better improved processes to manage all this. I think you're going to see, I don't want to venture a percentage, but I would love to see 50% someday of all cases that currently are go through and become admitted being handled at home. So, and that's where you, again, you save lots of costs, everyone's happier, and the quality is the same or better. Because think about it, you're convalescing at home. And when you're in the hospital, because again, I had a recent hospital stay, I had to stay two nights, one night in ICU, one night in telemetry. Every 2 hours, they were coming in and poking me, and it was uncoordinated. This wasn't at the Cleveland Clinic. It was at some other place, which I love that place. So I'm not saying anything bad. I'm just trying to describe to you the patient experience. They woke me up at least every 2 hours to poke me, and then they also came in to do vitals. They should, as they do in many hospitals and in Cleveland Clinic, do those at the same time, but they don't. So as a result, probably every hour I'm getting woken up. So it's not a fun experience. So anyways, if you can convalesce at home, the experience is much better, and you're with your family. It's less invasive on your family. So that's really the future, is hospital at home. And, you know, you see that already. An early start of that is the whole telemedicine, right? Everyone's familiar with that by now. There are some laws that need to be updated and improved, and there needs to be better reimbursement mechanisms. And those things are starting to hit depending on what state you're in. We do a lot of that at the Cleveland Clinic today and have for many years. But that's the only way that I engage in healthcare today, other than my heart attack episode, is I just pick up my phone and I engage with my caregiver via the phone. So that's the other wave of the future. So you'll see, I think already there's probably like 5 to 10% adoption, but I think you'll see that go up to 80 or 90%.
Wow. I can absolutely see that. And I hear your point. I can't tell you, unfortunately, you know, with our own personal family experiences, if I can avoid the hospital, I would much rather. I think people in general are much more comfortable with their own homes. And if I could simply call a doctor and say, hey, here are my symptoms that I'm feeling. Is it something to be worried about? Should I come in or should I not? I could see where, again, resources, minimizing the wait time in emergency rooms, right? For cases that are really urgent versus someone that, you know, let's be honest, might be on the other extreme, might be a hypochondriac.
Right.
I could see so much from a hospital perspective as well. You mentioned something here. I guess this all sounds great. I think, like we've discussed earlier, our society is now more inclined to accept this type of interaction. What is it, do you think, that is inhibiting us from being able to make this from 5% to an 80% adoption rate? What are the obstacles right now that you're seeing for hospitals in general and or for patients?
Yeah, I don't see too many obstacles for patients because, again, We're the patients are demanding these sort of things. And that's, unfortunately, you know, health system, hospitals are usually slow to adopt technology because we're very conservative by nature, and for good reason. There's good historical reason. You know, we do a lot of research to make sure that any medications, for instance, that you receive are safe. And there's a ton of research that's done. It takes a while. We call it bench to bedside. It used to be like, oh, I don't want to get my years right. It used to be 15 years bench to bedside. I think it's been cut in half. And I think we're going to see that increase, just talking in general, you know, research to actual, you know, to benefiting the patients. We're conservative by nature. So it's definitely not the patient side. So the patients are pushing us. And then I think the next thing is the payment mechanism. Because, you know, we are paid to provide services, and the way that most payment mechanisms are set up today, there's no incentive to adopt digital. Now, again, that is slowly changing, and I think it's going to accelerate. as consumers demand more and we try to focus more on cost. So for instance, value-based care. So we have a great product called Oscar. So Oscar is a digitally native payer that we've partnered with. And so all of our Oscar patients interact almost exclusively via their phone. You just set appointments, those sort of things. And that, but the arrangement with that payer is that everyone's incentivized to leverage digital as opposed with traditional fee for service. So in traditional fee for service mechanism, there's no incentive for digital. So that's the issue. So that's why I think, you know, the two main issues, you know, the secondary ones are ones we just talked about. One is, okay, maybe some of the population's not ready, but I think that's a small amount and getting smaller. We're conservative by nature and for good historical reasons, but the really big ones are, one is payment mechanisms. So the payment system of 30, 40 years ago hasn't caught up yet. It's starting to. Oscar is a great example, but and other sort of ACOs or accountable care organizations are good examples, but it's slow, right, to adopt. And then the second one is policy. So policy hasn't caught up on the state and federal level. Some states are better than others, but it's hard sometimes, like across state lines, to provide care because they require you to have state licensure in that particular state. And I just think those are false borders. And so I would love to see us take a more federal approach and remove borders from healthcare because they're arbitrary, really. And really start changing our payment systems and policy to enable further leveraging of digital health.
You just put in a mouthful of stuff here, which I did not realize. I didn't think about the policy side of it. Of course, I shouldn't have thought of that because healthcare is highly regulated. You have a lot of experience with policy. And I didn't know this, Ed. I apologize for all the years I've talked to you. Could you help me understand? You've had a very strong relationship with THSA, the Texas Legislators. I'm sorry, Texas Health Services Authority. In your experience working with them and talking to and working with, was it Governor Perry and Abbott?
Yes.
You said that you would like to see it at a more federal level. Is this something where, is Texas taking the lead here and trying to make this much more of a federal discussion, or is it still, are you saying right now with policy, it's still stuck in the state to state?
It was very exciting to work on behalf of the governor in Texas for, I think it was 8 years. And it was very interesting and eye-opening because I got to work with a lot of the state legislators and help develop policy and give testimony and things like that. So it was great. It was a very eye-opening experience. And I've been exposed to some other things since then on the federal level that have been very eye-opening. I'm glad to be a part of it. And certainly the Cleveland Clinic has a lot of effective relationships as well. Yeah, so I think that I wouldn't categorize myself on an expert on this particular, on the policy issues, but there are still state-to-state borders, and it's highly regulated at the interest, and I just want to be careful here because I don't want to get into a political discussion, but, you know, the various medical associations working with the state, you know, it can be very regulated, and so some states are more progressive than others. But I think in order to spur this on, what I'm saying is although I'm definitely a state rights sort of person on a personal level, I think getting a federal engagement will help here to say, look, when it comes to healthcare, we have a mandate across the country to increase the quality of our care for our citizens and do it at a price point that's less expensive than it is today. And one way is to do digital health. And therefore, we should have maybe one licensure for all clinicians that can cross state boundaries and allow providers to see patients from other states if that's what they want. You know, a lot of people come to certain providers for very specific care at the Cleveland Clinic from around the world. And so mm-hmm. when they go back to their states, you know, it should be simple and easy to continue to provide follow-up care and things like that. So I think there's more that could be done, you know, at the state and federal level to really help spur digital growth.
So I'm not as familiar with the specifics of HIPAA, for example, but this is kind of moving on where my head is with digital healthcare is going to require house a lot of data, right? We're going to be amassing a huge amount of data of if we're going to have these type of interactions. I can see where you're going down that path to say, okay, if I am here in Texas and you're in, you know, Cleveland, right, in Dallas area, if I want to talk to you, can my data be available, made available for you so that you can give me the proper healthcare you need so you have the proper information to help whatever issue I might have? Do you see data being more prominent from a healthcare perspective for the hospitals to have that accessibility of information? You know, and how would the office of the CIO be able to support that? I mean, that's a lot of data. So I guess my question would be, is, you know, what kind of investments are we looking at if we move, and we will move, this digital healthcare provider solution? How much investments are hospitals willing to make? Because this is going to be a huge investment.
Yeah, and I think on the sort of telemed side, it won't be so much investment specific to the telehealth, because we do have the capabilities with secure communication to sort of handle the HIPAA-related PHI type of things. But where the data gets really interesting, data health in a digital health, and we're just talking about one aspect, but there's so many different aspects, is really precision medicine. So that's something else that we've been pioneers of. And this is the concept of getting a lot of data and artificial intelligence and machine learning, genomics data, with your electronic medical record data that you're capturing, and ideally with payer information that you might have, and being able to do these predictive algorithms and predictive analytics that then lead to precision medicine. So an example would be, you know, we do these sort of things today. You know, we can predict with high accuracy who might be a candidate for readmission, right? We don't want anyone to be readmitted because it's not right. Number one, it's not good for the patient and their family. It's not good for quality of care. So we have the ability to predict who might come back. And so when we know that there's someone who's at high risk for coming back, we can take appropriate action and be proactive and reduce that likelihood of them coming back. Or we can risk stratify our patients and realize who's at high risk for diabetes and then take very proactive approaches to ensure they never get diabetes, or we manage the diabetes really carefully. So that's easy. Not many people are doing it, but that's not as hard as the next stage, which is this precision medicine. And this is the ability, now that I know all this stuff, I've been able to do predictive analytics, I've got all your genomics data, I know your history of, you know, what you respond to well in terms of drugs and things like that, is then saying, okay, now you have this particular issue, this medical challenge, how do we craft a treatment plan that's specific for Ed Marks? And so, you know, today, like if you have a fever, you might be given a standard medication, but that medication is only going to work for 50 to 60% of the population. So it's like trial and error, right? We give you that medicine. Oh, it didn't work for Saya. So we're going to give her some other drug. And so it's like experiment almost. But if we have all this other information and we know based on family history and again, genomics, that this specific aspirin, which is making up a silly example, is going to be perfect for you, then that's, so we deliver that and you get well, your fever goes down. And that's precision medicine. So I made a very simple example, but think if you had, you know, God forbid you had a cancer or something, and you don't want just, you know, a therapy that might work for 50% of the population. You want a therapy that's going to work 95% for you. And so that's where we're headed, you know, as an industry and certainly here at the Cleveland Clinic. So that's where data becomes this massive, you know, a massive amounts of data. So we do tons of genomics. We're leaders in the world in areas of genomics. And so we're amassing tons of data. And yeah, we have to be very smart with how we store that data, protect that data, and that, you know, there's data integrity and those sort of things. So it is a rising challenge for a lot of healthcare systems. But we certainly have a lot of good experience doing it already.
That's great. So I appreciate that. I'm actually really thrilled to hear that. We do hear about the evolution of leveraging more AI. Again, precision medicine, you've mentioned this before. It is, I guess, my question on this is, okay, so you hear about AI and you hear about, you know, artificial intelligence, virtual reality. Is this something where there's some fear around those terms, right? Because there's a certain amount of ignorance of, you know, Hollywood has, you know, made those words more evil sounding than what it actually is, right? Can you help clarify, just make sure we're clear on this. We're not looking at having some kind of robot, you know, talking to us when we're looking to get our healthcare, right? I mean, could you clarify exactly, like in virtual reality, for example, how would this be applied in a way that's realistic and not, you know, a Hollywood, you know, I don't know, what's that thing called? The Terminator kind of robot talking to me.
Yeah, so we've changed the name. So we use AI, but to us it doesn't mean artificial intelligence. It means augmented intelligence. So we never have plans to take away the human empathy. So we never have plans to replace a clinician who might hold your hand when you receive a terrible diagnosis or hug you when you celebrate being cancer-free. We will never replace that. That's just fundamental to who we are as an organization, about patients first and patient experience. So we call it augmented. So we want to give our clinicians the tools to make them more efficient and accurate when seeing their patients, for instance. So if they have a tool while they're seeing you that helps them sort of prioritize faster than they could in their own mind based on the inputs that they're receiving, sort of what questions to ask, that's what we consider augmented intelligence. So it's them asking the question, but they might be prompted based on your answers and the machine learning behind the scenes, based on your answers, to focus in and hone in on something. Because, you know, the medical information available today is, you know, and the amount that is produced on a daily basis is more than any human could possibly take.
Right.
So if we have systems that can augment the clinician and the augmentation understands all the new research, all the new studies, and the clinician is also up to date, but obviously can't memorize, you know, libraries full of information. But they know enough to ask the right questions. And when they ask the right questions, you have augmented intelligence helping them along, saying, oh, based on everything I just heard Ed say, think about X. You know, it's maybe only one in a million, but ask the question, because what if? And so we see that as how we will use it or are using it.
So if I'm understanding correctly in this context, is it something where, based on our recording here, like you and I are doing a video chat, is it something where like a chat bot is like listening on the side and then kind of scrolling as the clinician's talking to the patient?
Right. Correct.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. And so it's just augmenting the interaction, because you want real-time feedback. You don't want to get a report 24 hours later and then there's another question that's asked, and then based on that question, that might lead to another permutation of questions. You want to know right then and there, right? So this is just augmenting the experience. The other thing we're doing is we're completely, you know, remember the Cleveland Clinic, we have a three-part mission, which is sacred to who we are. So we've been focused all on the provider side, but we're also a research organization and education organization. So we have this new med school, beautiful med school that's about to open. And in it, we're revolutionizing, along with Case Western, our academic partner, the way that we train our future clinicians. And one way is augmented reality. And so I've participated in this, where you wear goggles, and someday it'll just be like glasses. But right now, it's still kind of awkward goggles. But you do all your human anatomy through augmented reality. And it's quite fascinating. And we found that the retention rate for the students is higher than when they had a real cadaver. And real cadavers are an issue because they're expensive to maintain. You know, they're not easy to work with. And so by doing augmented reality, you get the same experience, but better, because now you're actually walking inside the heart chambers and you're looking around and seeing the aortic wall and you can touch things. And so the learning environment is much richer. And so that's an example of how we're doing doing augmented reality to assist with our training of the next generation of clinicians.
Well, I mean, I can see that absolutely being a cost savings. I mean, and you said consistency. Unfortunately, as humans, we're not the same. So I can imagine for these future doctors, how different their experiences with each cadaver.
Yeah, and it's easier to get dates, is what I'm told.
I can see that.
You don't smell like formaldehyde.
I was just gonna say, yeah, there's all those chemicals you have to touch. Yeah. That's crazy. So, let's shift it a little bit because I think, this is a great conversation. I know you and I could talk about this all day long, but, you know, as a leader, and you're seeing all of this technology being leveraged today, you know, it's not simply just a matter of keeping the lights running anymore or keeping, the computers, keeping help desk running, et cetera. I mean, you gave a great speech at the HIT Summit earlier this year, and I kind of want to go over it real quick here is you gave the message of saying leaders, in technology, you need to take risks and lead proactively. And it really took to heart for me because I feel at times technology, though we are at the forefront of helping move business forward with, making them more efficient, et cetera, I do sense at times that technology leaders tend to be pushed back as a overhead versus a source of innovation for whatever industry and business. So could you help me understand what you were trying to tell the audience and, how can that be applied to really make innovation move along faster than it currently is?
Yeah, I always try to encourage my peer group to take a more active role. A lot of people I think it's just the way we were raised, perhaps, in technology as young leaders, that it was all about bits and bytes and just to be reactive. And I'm like, no. We are, especially today, we have to be sitting at the executive table and we have to be, and if we earn that right to be there, we need to earn the right to stay there. And sometimes we earn the right, progressive organizations will earn that right. They'll have the position there, but then you have to earn the right to stay. It's always challenging myself, my teams, like, how are we contributing to the objectives of our organization? How are we helping with research? How are we helping with education? How are we helping with providing care and quality and patient safety? So you have to be really active and don't put yourself in this typecast box that says that you can only talk when technology is spoken about. Well, for one, technology underlies just about everything now, whether it's stated implicitly or not. And two, you're a leader first, not a technologist. So once you reach the C-suite, you're a leader first, not a techie. So, and I have the benefit, and not that this is helpful, but not a requirement. I have the benefit that I didn't grow up through the technical ranks. So I actually have clinical experience as well as business experience. But you can learn. You can make some substitutes no matter where you are in your career to learn those aspects. So anyways, to be proactive. So I hear all the time, I'm an executive team and we meet Monday mornings at 7 a.m. and we talk about a lot of things. We talk about our mission, our objectives, and I know all the pain points that we're trying to improve for patient safety and quality of care in different areas or growth or revenue. And it's like I'm an active member and I provide input and I can talk about how we can do certain things, and sometimes it's technology enabled, sometimes it isn't. So I jump in and contribute, and that's what's needed. And a lot of times, again, because of poor teaching of the past or just old tradition, we're taught to keep quiet unless you're talking about technology or just to be reactive. Or the other one is like, there's no such thing as a technology project, or I think that's how the people say it. And so I'm not going to lead anything. I always look for opportunities to lead, whether or not it's technical or not. And so it's like, no, contribute. It doesn't matter. So if no one wants to lead it, but it's really important for the organization, yep, we're going to lead it. And it's okay that we're leading it from technology point of view because we understand the business. And so we do a lot of things, which back to my point earlier, I was fortunate to be a combat medic and then later an anesthesia aide, anesthesia tech. Not everyone has that clinical experience. And then I worked on the business side, so I understand the business side of healthcare. But you can do things to substitute that. So you can learn. So like we have all of our weekly meetings for my team at our institutes, which is like, the specialty parts of our organization. Like yesterday we met in the cancer hospital, Taussig Cancer Center, and we met with the institute chair and his assistant, and we learn and we hang out. And then, so we do that every week at a hospital or at another institute. We have like 20 some institutes. So we just rotate around every year. Once a year for all of them. And we just learn directly from them. And then we shadow. So we have a program where you have to shadow a clinician one day a year. It doesn't seem like a lot, but it's a lot, especially when you do it multiple years. For my leaders, myself, I try to do that once a month, spend a whole day. I also volunteer. So that's another thing you can do. So I volunteer. My mom died 11 years ago, ovarian cancer. So I volunteer weekly at the Taussig Cancer Center. And it's only in a couple hours a week, but I see the caregivers, I see the nurses, I talk with patients. And so I'm always learning, understanding what they're, and they tell me, the patients tell me about things, and I just listen, I learn. And so there's a lot of things you can do to really get to know the business. So that's what doesn't happen. They might be strong techies, but they don't know the business. And the higher you get, the less techie you have to be, because you hire people who are techie and understand all this stuff. You really need to focus on the business. So, and then focus on leadership. Try and learn. I whatever book my CEO is reading, I'm reading the same book. Whatever he talks about, going to conference or following someone, I follow the same person. I know what his Twitter account is. I can see who he follows. I follow the same people. So I do the same with the other C-suite executives. So I know I'm trying to know them. So I don't want to ramble, but those are just four or five things right off the top of my head that can help differentiate you and help you add value to your organization.
You nailed it on the head right there. Research, educate yourself on the business, educate yourself with the people that are around you in the same C-level suite, embrace a lot of the business goals and objectives. These are such critical things that you think that's intuitive, Ed. I mean, what you're saying is I get it, but I'm sure that everyone could use more of it, right? Can embrace it, really understand the books that they're reading. They're not just reading for, just because the CEO's reading, you're actually embracing the message within those books. It's not rocket science, but it's discipline. That's a lot of commitment.
It's just get involved. So I was talking with someone, I take a lot of calls from peers who are trying to, they see something that they want to improve on, and I'm always happy to help them. And this person's trying to get sort of that big CIO position. And so I talked to him about a lot of these things. And then I said, I don't ever see you present. I don't see you write. I don't see you tweet. I don't see you on LinkedIn. And it's like you have to network is part of it too, because you're exposed to other people and you learn new ideas and you talk to people. And that broadens you. If I'm limited to my knowledge of today, 2 years from now, oh my gosh, the world has passed me up. So, and I can't do that. I made a pledge, an implicit promise to my employer when I took this role, so for the Cleveland Clinic, that I'm going to be the very best CIO they've ever had. And we're going to have the best patient experiences that we've ever had and caregiver experiences. And so I owe it to my organization to continuously learn and improve myself and reach out, and by interacting with others and networking, like the examples I gave you, it does so many things. One is the network, and you learn from others and you listen. But the other thing is when you prepare to make a talk, you have to study, you have to research. And so that's why I'm sort of up to date on different things. It's not because I graduated with a degree in there. It's because I'm continuously investing in myself, because the more I invest in myself, the more I can give away. You have to give yourself so you can give away what you received. So it's just basic.
And right there is so why it is. And in the teams that I've seen you work with, I can absolutely see it trickling down, because again, with true leadership, right, you're setting the example, you're in essence setting the pace for the rest of the organization, the tone for how you want to set the culture. I mean, is there anything specific you are looking at for your own team members at the Cleveland Clinic? Is there any personality traits or anything that you do that you'd like to impart and share with the audience today?
Well, people have heard this before, but I live by it. It's like I try to hire people that are better than me, because I told you a couple times already, I'm pretty average. So if I can hire people that are better than me, then we're going to be this rock star team. So I've made a couple of key hires recently I'm very, very excited about. They're definitely better than me. I knew these people before, and I admired them. And so now we get to work together on a team. And that's really the secret. And so to the extent that you can build your team with people you could trust and just that are have a similar philosophies and are passionate about service and about taking care of patients. So I look for, you know, so in summary is hire people to better yourself, but look for people of passion. You mentioned that in the very beginning of the podcast. Passion, that's key because, you know, it's hard work, right? It's a very beautiful work, but there's no denying there's a lot of long hours and hard work. But if you're surrounded by people of passion, that just really helps carry you through the hard times. It's like, well, okay, yeah, our mission, and we're here for one another. We carry one another when one has fallen. So so that's really important, is that passion piece. And that's something you can't teach. So I just try to hire for it.
Excellent. And it is true. You cannot teach passion. That's for sure. I call it fire in the belly.
Yeah, right.
You've got fire in the belly, whatever it might be. So, you know, Ed, we're kind of like getting on the, we're wrapping up here. And I just want to say thank you first off for the time. Is there anything that you'd like to announce or anything you'd like to promote or advocate or just leave a message with for us?
No, I have nothing to promote or advocate. I just encourage my peers and anyone listening to, you know, find that passion. If you don't have it, you know, whatever it might be is explore yourself, try to find your authentic self and get excited about something, and then, you know, change the world. We have very limited time. You know, that was made known to me on April 7th. So you got to do what you can while you're here to make something happen.
Wow. Yeah.
I love it.
Aaron, is there anything that you'd like to?
No, I just, great words of wisdom. I didn't expect it to twist like that from a digital healthcare perspective, but I think it's true. It's that advice just goes through all aspects of life, all industries, all everything. Put yourself out there, continually improve, and I love the passion side. So no, I think that's a great note to leave it on.
Cool.
Great. And so just to, in summary, real quick here from our conversation, Ed, I mean, you have done so much. I mean, I can't even begin to, we haven't even touched the surface of the depth of your life experiences professionally and personally. But my takeaways here is, again, obviously with passion, it seems to me with any level of innovation, if you want to make a difference, it really comes down to you want to do it. Okay, I guess we can go use that passion word again. You have to have the discipline to maintain it.
Yeah.
And a plan to execute on it. And any real true innovation that's going to evolve, anything that's going to change our current state of life is going to have to take work. And, you know, we're seeing it now. I'm watching you, you know, all the postings coming out of Cleveland Clinic. It's already the most innovative, you know, hospital here in the United States. You guys are doing amazing things. And, you know, Ed, I'm really excited to see. I know every announcement that Cleveland Clinic comes out with, I know you're going to be the underpinning to execute and make it happen. So, you know, on behalf of us regular patients out there, thank you very much for all your hard work, because we're just going to get the fruits of your labor for that. Again, thank you very much for your time. And, I definitely look forward to seeing and hearing from you again, Ed.
Yes, thank you so much. It's been an honor to be part of your podcast.